Okay, last week we were discussing Romans 3 on your outline at page 2. The covenant form in the book of Deuteronomy and its historical implications. Just to refresh our minds, A was the structural integrity of the books often been questioned. The usual approach to Deuteronomy is to find it maybe with an original core, but it's a lot of supplementary accretions and a double introduction, various things like that. Von Rad called attention to the significance of Deuteronomy's structural pattern in the problem of the Hexateuch in 1938. In 1938, Von Rad looked at the book and said, there is a coherent structure to this thing. And remember, I gave you an outline of that. He wanted to look at it form critically, and he felt that the whole did display a structural unity. But then C, Meredith Klein, utilized a form critical methodology honoring the integrity of Scripture to open a new perspective on the structure of Deuteronomy, which in turn has implications for its interpretation and date. We spent most of our time on C last week, and points 1 through 12 was my attempt to try to summarize Klein's argument on that treaty covenant analogy and then the implications of that analogy for date. That brings us to the top page 3, which is D. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications, the present state of affairs in the Deuteronomy debate. Now, probably this D will take us most of today. I hope I can finish this up today. And that leaves us 2 weeks to go on to the centralization of worship question. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But that's where we begin then with D. And under D I have 1, the nature of the covenant form and its origin, cultic or historical. Well, before getting to 1, let me make some general comments. On the heading, the covenant form, the Old Testament, and its historical implications. Present state of affairs in Deuteronomy studies. I think there's widespread agreement today that there is a discernible covenant form as to be found in the Old Testament. And that form can be found in the structure of the book of Deuteronomy. It can be found in a number of other places as well. Most of the people who have discussed this find it in Exodus 19 to 24. That's the Sinai material where the covenant was originally established. Most find it in Joshua chapter 24. Joshua 24 is where Joshua calls all Israel to Shechem to renew their allegiance to the Lord. And I think Joshua 24 can rightly be called a covenant renewal ceremony. It's at the end of Joshua's life. He calls the people to renew their allegiance to the Lord to the point of his imminent death. You have a transition in leadership, very much as you see in the book of Deuteronomy, which is the end of Moses' life, and a transition in leadership, and the attempt to provide for covenant continuity, you might say, through that time of transition and leadership. But you find in Joshua 24 those same elements of the treaty form that you find in the book of Deuteronomy. And then if you go on to 1 Samuel 12, my dissertation dealt with 1 Samuel 12. I think in 1 Samuel 12 you find the same, or at least a number of the same elements of the treaty form or covenant form. That chapter is at the close of Samuel's life, where he is providing for the transition to the monarchy with the establishment of Saul as king. And my own view is that 1 Samuel 11, 14 through 12, 25 is a covenant renewal ceremony at Gilgal called to ensure covenant continuity with the change from the period of the judges to that of the monarchy and to provide for that transition. But my point is, there's quite a broad agreement that you find such this thing called the covenant form in Exodus, Deuteronomy, Joshua, and 1 Samuel 12. not by any means unanimous, but a fairly good consensus on that. However, there's no corresponding agreement on the origin of the form, and consequently on its historical implications. That's where you get into more dispute and discussion. And many will recognize the form is there, but what's its origin? What are the historical implications of the form? Some scholars have resisted attempts to draw historical conclusions from the presence of the literary form. They just want to look at the form, but they don't want to. Don't want to draw historical conclusions from that. In my book, page 144, note 30. A man named Balzer, who wrote a book called The Covenant Formulary, commenting on Mendelssohn's article, Law and Covenant in Israel in the Ancient Near East, says, quote, of Mendelssohn, he's more interested in historical questions, while the present work limits itself to the form-critical approach. No doubt further conclusions, not least in the historical sphere, can be drawn on the basis of this beginning, but I consider it methodologically dangerous to bring both sets of questions together prematurely. And what Balzer is doing is hesitating to draw historical conclusions from the presence of the form. He says it's methodologically dangerous to bring both sets of questions together prematurely. And then there's a German scholar there that says, the quote's in German, but the translation is, the historical channels, this man named Stamm, says the historical channels by which one can explain the similarity of the Hittite vassal treaties to the formulation of the Old Testament covenant are still quite unclear. So what's the historical connection between the Hittite treaty form and the covenant? He says it's quite unclear. Then another fellow says, Calderon of Balzer, speaking of Balzer, he says, Balzer insists throughout on a sharp separation between his form critical investigation and the historicity of the episodes narrated. This reserve towards matters historical, which still lies far short of skepticism, owes its vigor to the influence of Altnoth and von Rath. In this way, Balzer has successfully avoided hasty and premature conclusions. An author has the right to delimit his scope and material, but it is disappointing that Balzer eschews historical conclusions. And then D.J. McCarthy says, no doubt too much has been claimed for the analogy, and especially illegitimate historical conclusions have been drawn from it. Still, this does not invalidate such evidence as there is for the analogy. In other words, you keep the analogy, but be careful about drawing historical conclusions from the analogy. Well, I think there certainly the caution is in order. When you get into form-critical questions, it certainly, I think that's where the form-critical method is often abused. You get a certain form, then you make very speculative kinds of reconstructions of the setting that produced the form, and the historical conclusions that drawn may be very questionable. But you see, the whole thing about the form-critical methodology is if you have a certain literary form, it presupposes a certain historical setting that gave rise to the form. And that's the, you know, in the technical term, the Sitzen Leben that gave rise to the form. And you want to get back and understand what that situation was that produced the form. And it seems to me that a judicious attempt, to delineate the historical setting for a particular form can be a useful interpretive tool. And it seems to me here we have a certain form, and judiciously we can ask what was the setting that gave rise to it, and that can help in understanding the significance and the interpretation of the form in question. If you avoid that, you impoverish the study of the form. And so I think here when we're talking about the covenant form and its historical implications, that certainly we need caution, but we shouldn't refuse to draw the historical implications from the covenant form. All right, one, under that is the nature of the covenant form and its origin, cultic or historical. Now, I've put that heading that way because not that cultic or historical need necessarily to be opposites. Something can be cultic and historical at the same time. In fact, in a very real sense, I think this form is cultic and historical. The covenant was established at Sinai in a situation where the covenant was ratified with sacrifices and sprinkling of blood and so forth. So you could say it's cultic, but at the same time it's historical. The reason I put it that way is because of what von Rad has done with this. Remember last week, and even previous to that, we noted that von Rad spoke of a structure to the book of Deuteronomy way back in 1938. And I think I gave you that last week, the way he outlined the book and the structure he saw. He proposed that that structure was derived from the cult. And he felt that the structure was preserved in Israel and passed on in Israel and found its place in the book of Deuteronomy from the preaching of the Levites. And it was a cultic origin for the form. Now, you see, that was 38. That was before anybody called attention to the treaty covenant analogy. It was long before that. Mendenhall's article was in 54. So it's quite a bit later. With the more recent treaty material being brought to light, von Rad's not changed his position, although he recognizes and accepts the treaty covenant analogy. If you look in his Old Testament theology, which was published in 57, this is the first volume of that, page 132, he says, comparison of ancient Near Eastern treaties, especially those made by the Hittites in the 14th, 13th centuries BC, with passages in the Old Testament has revealed so many things in common between the two, particularly the matter of form, that there must be some connection between these suzerainty treaties and the exposition of the details of Yahweh's covenant with Israel given in certain passages in the Old Testament. And then he gives a review of much of what we've discussed, the structure of the treaties and how that compares with the biblical material. And he says that this is found in a number of passages, including those that I just mentioned. And he says, even if there are still many questions of detail to be answered, there is at least no doubt that the two kinds of material are related to one another. There's the treaty and the covenant material. The relationship in respect of form can be traced down into text of post-apostolic time. Here, of course, Israel took over, but we remember the age of some of the relevant Old Testament material. When we remember the age of some of the relevant Old Testament material, we have to reckon that she became acquainted with this treaty schema very early on, perhaps even as soon as the time of the Judges. Now, that's interesting. He says that that's basic structure. Israel must have become acquainted with it very early in her history, perhaps as early as the time of the Judges. But that was 57 in his theology. Yes? Well, I think he finds it. He sees it in Joshua 24, for example, which would be the beginning of that period. I think it probably it would be because of Joshua 24. That was, what was that, 57. In 64, he published this commentary on Deuteronomy. And he again discusses this now in connection with Deuteronomy, page 21 to 23. And he says, finally, we must mention one type of composition used in Deuteronomy, which scholars have only recently recognized, namely the formulary used for covenants. The discussion of this has only just begun. It's been known for some time that potentates in the ancient Near East, especially the Hittites, used to draw up their treaties with their vassals according to a definite pattern. But it was astonishing to realize that this treaty pattern can be traced in not a few parts of the Old Testament, and amongst others in Deuteronomy. And again, then he discusses that form, which I won't repeat. But he says, at the time of Deuteronomy, this pattern had long been used freely for literary and homiletic purposes, even individual units appearing sporadically. Place it beyond all doubt, they are modeled on the full form already mentioned. But then he says, the question is still quite open, how and when Israel came to understand its relationship to God in the form of these early Near Eastern treaties with vassals. The question is still open, how and when Israel came to understand its relationship to God in the form of these early Near Eastern treaties with vassals. Later on, he says, if we ask what Sitzim Laban is demanded by the pattern in accordance with which Deuteronomy is arranged, it can have been taken only from a cultic celebration. See, there's his cultic origin idea. It can be taken only from a cultic celebration, perhaps from a feast of renewal of the covenant. This conjecture is supported by the insertion of a formal covenant making, Deuteronomy 26:16-19. Thus, the classical pattern of the regular covenant formulary appears in Deuteronomy, in any case, only in mutilated form, its setting in the cult in which the form of Deuteronomy was originally rooted, has in fact been already abandoned in the book as we now have it. That is because its contents now appear in the form of a homiletic instruction for the laity. In other words, what he's saying is, even though you find that treaty covenant analogy in the structure of the book, the basic form of Deuteronomy is in the form of homiletic instruction for the laity. And he gets right back into his Levitical theory that the Levites preserve this in preaching, and it's the recollection of ancient traditions preserved in the cult and passed on down through the generations. So that then, when he comes to his conclusion of date of Deuteronomy, page 26, he says, we shall suppose one of the northern sanctuaries, Shechem or Bethel, to be Deuteronomy's place of origin, and the century before 621 must be its date. There's no sufficient reason for going further back. In other words, century before 621, you see then 721 being the 700s, fairly late. And he feels that the form that you find in Deuteronomy is a form derived from the cult preserved by the preaching of the Levites. So you see, it's really a cultic derivation for the origin of the form, even though he recognizes the parallel with the Hittite treaty material. Now, it seems to me that that cultic origin hypothesis really doesn't give an adequate explanation for the nature of the form in question and its use in the Old Testament. It really doesn't answer the more basic question of the occasion and reason for the initial utilization of the form. What was the occasion and reason for the initial utilization of the form? When was it? He really doesn't address that, you see. Bible presents the initial utilization of it as being in the presentation of the covenantal materials by God to Moses at Sinai. And that is the origin of it. So, you know, as Klein says, God used the legal instrument of the Hittite treaty form, which was a known form of his day, as a means of presenting his covenant to his people and structuring it along the lines of that known legal instrument. J.A. Thompson, in an article called The Cultic Credo and the Sinai Tradition, I don't know if that's in your bibliography or not. Let's see. Yes. It's on page 5 of your bibliography. J.A. Thompson, The Cultic Credo and the Sinai Tradition. Reformed Theological Review, says this. He's discussing von Rad's approach to this question. He says, there seems little reason to doubt that the historical prologue in the secular treaties was a basic aspect of any treaty. Nor need we doubt that it represented, albeit perhaps in some enhanced form, a correct outline of the preceding historical events, which were paraded as a strong argument for the acceptance of the treaty by the vassal. The historical prologue in the treaties gives us real history, tells us of previous relationship between the great king and the vassal, which provides a basis then of obligation on the part of the vassal toward the great king. All right. He says, von Rad does, of course, take note of the historical recital of the Sinai events when he discusses Deuteronomy in Exodus 19 to 24. First part of Deuteronomy, which functions as a historical prologue, goes back and reviews Sinai. But for him, this historical narration is merely a cultic legend of very doubtful historicity. But the question should be asked whether a cultic legend could serve the purpose demanded. See, the way the historical prologue functions is these things really had to happen if they're going to be a basis for the ongoing relationship. Thompson says it ought not be assumed that a cultic liturgy should be divorced from underlying historical events. I think that's the point. Maybe there was a preservation that's forming the cult. That's somewhat speculative and so forth. But you see, where did it start? When did it originate? What is the historical basis for the thing? And it seems to me that at that point, von Rad's cultic derivation view is deficient. That relationship, covenant relationship, was established at a specific historical occasion, the establishment of the covenant at Sinai. And the form presupposes that specific historical occasion when the covenant was originally and formally established. So I think you get back again to that point of the significance of the Mosaic era and the establishment of the covenant at Sinai for all that follows in the Old Testament. So that's one. The nature of the covenant form and its origin, cultic or historical, it seems to me von Rad doesn't do justice to that question of the origin of the form. And we go back to Sinai to find the setting for the initial introduction of that form into Israel's religious traditions and beliefs. Two, we're talking about the present state of affairs in Deuteronomy debate. Two is the evolution of the treaty form and its implications for the date of the book of Deuteronomy. When we discussed Klein's view last week, I think, I hope it became clear to you that a great part of his case for the Mosaic origin of Deuteronomy lies with his claim that the treaty form went through an evolutionary development in the sense that there was a classic Hittite pattern which is not duplicated in later treaties, particularly the Esarhaddon treaties and the Sapiri treaty. Now, I want to look at that question a little closer, precisely because that is a point which has been questioned. And there's a lot that rests on it. So, let's go to the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon compared with the Hittite suzerainty treaties. And one is introductory remarks. The vassal treaties of Esarhaddon were discovered in 1955 by British archaeologists in what is present-day Iraq. 1955 by British archaeologists were discovered in Iraq at a place called Nimrud, N-I-M-R-U-D. The tablets were found in the throne room of the Temple of Nabu amid debris resulting from destruction of the building by fire in 612 by the Medes. And these texts were found, identified as a treaty by a woman named Barbara Parker. And it was a treaty made by Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, in 672 B.C. There was more than one treaty, but the text was the same. It's just that the treaty was concluded with a number of different individuals. And the name changes, not Esarhaddon's, but the subordinate name changes. But the texts were duplicates, differing only in the names of the various rulers with whom they were made. So the treaties, really it's a treaty text of Esarhaddon with various vassal states. See if I have that on the bibliography. But they were published by D.J. Wiseman in a volume that's called Iraq, volume 20 in 1958. Iraq is the name of the journal. Volume 20, 1958. If you look at those treaties, you'll find that certain elements are very much like those of the earlier Hittite treaties. There's some resemblances. But in spite of those similarities, there are also some important differences. And you'll see that difference, I think, immediately when you look at the structure. Because if you look at the structure, it follows those six elements. First, a preamble. Second, gods as witnesses. Third, stipulations. Fourth, curses. Fifth, oath of allegiance. And then sixth, another section of curses. Curses in the form of similes. Now let me make a few comments on each of those. First, the preamble, as in the Hittite treaties, it introduces the parties to the treaty. And in the case of these Esarhaddon treaties, it then pinpoints the purpose of the document. Esarhaddon says the treaty is made, quote, concerning Ashurbanipal, the crown prince, son of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria. The point of this treaty was to ensure that when Esarhaddon died, this particular son, Ashurbanipal, crown prince, would succeed him. So it had to do with succession to the throne of Assyria. And the purpose then was concerning Ashurbanipal, crown prince, son of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria. And this treaty was to be binding on all the rulers over which Esarhaddon held power in the Assyrian Empire. And there are a number of copies of this treaty with different individuals that have been found. All right, so that's the preamble. Gods as witnesses is the second section. In which you have a list of the gods in whose presence the treaty was concluded. There's indication in the text of a ceremony at which the images of these gods were brought, and before whom then the treaty was officially enacted and put into effect. C, 17 deities are enumerated. So you have that list of gods. Thirdly, stipulations. The stipulations are rather narrowly focused in this sense. They're designed to ensure the permanence of the rule of Assurbanipal as the designated successor to Esarhaddon. That's the concern of the treaty. To ensure the permanence of the rule of Assurbanipal as a designated successor to Esarhaddon. So what the stipulations attempt to address is every conceivable kind of situation that might be a threat to Assurbanipal's position as successor. And you almost have to read the treaty to appreciate the extent of the provisions and the contingencies they cover. There are 33 clauses which the vassal swears to keep. They can be classified into five groups. First, those that ensure the loyalty of the vassal to Assurbanipal as Esarhaddon's successor. Those that ensure the loyalty of the vassal to Assurbanipal as Esarhaddon's successor. Secondly, those that outline action to be taken against rebels. Action to be taken against rebels. Thirdly, those that preclude attempts to usurp the throne. Those that preclude attempts to usurp the throne. Fourth, those that prohibit intrigue with other members of the royal household aimed at dethroning Assurbanipal. Those that prohibit intrigue with other members of the royal household aimed at dethroning Assurbanipal. For example, I'll just read you a couple. Not to respond to any approaches to turn E against A as crown prince. Not to be influenced by anyone claiming personal powers. To report to A any plot to make division between A and his brothers. So it goes on, a number of them. And then fifthly, emphasize the perpetual and binding nature of the oaths taken. Those that emphasize the perpetual and binding nature of the oaths taken. So you see, the stipulations are narrowly focused, as I said. It all has to do with securing the right of succession and the continuance in power of Assurbanipal after Esarhaddon's death. All right, fourth is curses. After 355 lines of stipulations governing the vassal's relationship to Esarhaddon and Assurbanipal, then you have the document protected by the pronouncement of a curse on anyone who changes, neglects, or transgresses the oaths of the tablet or erases it. Each god is separately named, and a particular curse characteristic of the activity of each particular god is pronounced. You had all these deities you see up here. And then under the curses, each of those deities is listed again with a particular curse linked. For example, may Shamash, the light of the heavens and earth, not judge you justly, saying, may it be dark in your eyes, walk in darkness. Shamash was a sun god. And so, so you have a curse connected with the particular characteristic of the deity involved. So you have the wrath of many of these deities invoked on someone who would transgress the stipulations. Then fifthly, an oath of allegiance. The vassals in this section swear allegiance to Esarhaddon and Assurbanipal. And the language here switches to the first person plural. That indicates that the document was intended to be used as a public ceremony, in which the people would say, we do this. So you have that oath of allegiance. Six, curses in the form of similes. After the oath of allegiance, you return to curses. And most of these are formulated in a style that uses similes from common observation. For example, just as male and female kids and male and female lambs are slit open and their entrails roll down over their feet, so may the entrails of your sons and your daughters roll down over your feet. It's a long section with similes of that sort, cursed similes. Wiseman suggests that a number of them, if not all of them, may have been demonstrated before the people to vividly illustrate the results of breaking the treaty. In other words, maybe with that one, where it speaks of the entrails of male and female kids rolling down over their feet, they may have sliced some of these animals open to demonstrate, and this so will have happened to you. I almost have to read this to get the picture. But for example, just as rain does not fall from a brazen heaven, so may rain and dew not come upon your fields and your meadows. May it rain burning coals instead of dew on your land. Just as a starving ewe puts the flesh of her young in her mouth, even so may he feed you and your hunger with the flesh of your brothers and your sons and your daughters. Just as a snake and a mongoose do not enter and lie down together in the same hole and think only of cutting off each other's life, so may you and your womenfolk not enter the same room without thinking of cutting off each other's lives. Some gruesome things in this. Well, after that section, the treaty ends rather abruptly with the date and a brief statement of the treaty's concern, and that is Assurbanipal being appointed crown prince and successor then to Esarhaddon. All right. That's a brief survey of the form. Number three begins to draw some of the contrasts or differences between the Assyrian treaty text and the Hittite. Number three is absence of a historical prologue. Absence of a historical prologue. As we noted earlier, the Hittite treaties have a rather consistent form with little deviation. The most striking contrast between the Hittite treaties and the Assyrian is that second section of the Hittite treaty form, the historical prologue, is not found in the Assyrian treaty. Remember, Hittite treaties went like this. Preamble, historical prologue, stipulation. Basic and detailed witnesses, curses, and blessings. The Assyrian treaties do not have the historical prologue. Now, that's an important difference. For this reason, the historical prologue in the Hittite treaty sets the tone for the treaties. It's on the basis of the benevolent acts of the great king that are enumerated in the historical prologue that the vassal has a sense of responsibility and obligation to be obedient to the treaty stipulations. So you get the historical prologue, which is followed by the stipulations. The historical prologue provides the sense of obligation on the part of the vassal. It's a benevolent great king. So it's on the basis of those prior beneficent acts that the great king justifies the demand for observance of the stipulations. There is a historical prologue, or at least room for one, on broken text, of every presently available Hittite treaty. Now, I say that even though that's a point of debate. The initial study of the Hittite treaties, before Mendenhall called attention to the analogy between the covenant materials and the Hittite treaty text, the treaty text had been published long before that and had been studied, but the connection had never been made with the covenant material in the Old Testament. And there's I believe it's a Hungarian scholar, Victor Koroshe, K-O-R-O-S-E-C, who published a volume in 1931 in German discussing the Hittite treaty text. It was the standard treatment of the Hittite treaty text, but just looked at it without the biblical comparison. Koroshe said in 1931 of the historical prologue, he said, "The constant recurrence of such expressions shows that in Hattusas, capital of the Hittite Empire, one regarded it as an essential element of every vassal treaty." In his study of the text, that was his conclusion. Now, more recently, you have the work of D.J. McCarthy, who published this volume, Treaty and Covenant. I believe that's on your bibliography, which has now come out in a later edition even than this one. The bottom of page... No, it's the top of page 5, Treaty and Covenant. Rome, Pontifical Biblical Institute Press, 1978. McCarthy contests the idea that every Hittite treaty has a historical prologue. And he says some of them don't have a historical prologue. And consequently, he says, the historical prologue was not an essential element in the treaty form. Now, you get involved in a lot of detailed discussions about that issue, but let me just call your attention. McCarthy says it's not an essential element in the form. Herbert Huffman disagrees with McCarthy on that. And if you look... I don't have it on your bibliography, unfortunately. But Herbert Huffman wrote an article called The Exodus, Sinai, and the Credo in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, Volume 27, 1965. Herbert Huffman, The Exodus, Sinai, and the Credo, Catholic Biblical Quarterly, Volume 27, 1965. And he interacts with McCarthy on this question. Catholic Biblical Quarterly, Volume 27, 1965, pages 109 to 110. He supports Koroshe. Huffman says, quote, "The omission of the historical prologue and the tendency for more elaborate and colorful curses in the first millennium treaties," that is the Esarhaddon treaty, "represents a basic change in the concept of the treaty relationship. Power replaces persuasion, such that although the treaty form continues to be the same in many respects, it is misleading to state that the treaties remain basically unchanged, contra D.J. Wiseman and McCarthy, who minimized the difference in the treaties. Now, I won't take the time to go into the detailed discussion of that, but let me just mention, McCarthy says five of the treaties, the early treaties, do not have a historical prologue. Five of the early Hittite treaties, McCarthy says, don't have a historical prologue. And so he says, history was not an essential element of the treaty form. Now, Huffman points out, if you look down here, historical prologue missing, question mark, those are the five treaties that McCarthy says are missing the historical prologue. Huffman analyzes all five of them and concludes that McCarthy really doesn't have a basis for the conclusion he's drawing from looking at those treaties. For example, the first one, the treaty between Marsilius II and Nikniapa of Ugarit, Huffman says it does have a prologue, but it's a very short one. It says, "As for you, Nikniapa, I restored you to your country and caused you to sit as king on the throne of your father." That's a historical prologue, one sentence. But you see what Huffman's saying is, this historical prologue is there, even though McCarthy says it's not. And I think Huffman is right. The second one, treaty between Marsilius II and Piacilius, it's a fragmentary treaty. It doesn't have a prologue in the expected place, but Huffman says that's not decisive. He says, "For although McCarthy states that in no instance does this section, prologue, occur anywhere except between titles and stipulations, he has overlooked the Hittite version of the treaty between Supiuliumus I and Aziru, in which the sequence is preamble, stipulations, prologue." And what he claims is there is a prologue in this text, but it's in a different order. It doesn't follow the standard order. The third one, the treaty between Supiuliumus and Hutanus, does have a prologue. Again, it's brief. Quote, "See you, Hutanus, I have received you as a simple but capable man, have honored you, and have received you in Hattusas, in the midst of the people, have introduced you in a friendly way, have given you my sister for a wife." Functions as a historical prologue. So I won't go through the four and five, but with all of them, you get into a rather technical debate. Does the treaty have a prologue or not? McCarthy says no. I think Huffman has shown that they do. There's a reasonable response. So that the absence of a historical prologue is a deviation from the Hittite form, and it's an important one, as I mentioned before, because the prologue sets the tone of the treaty. Instead of a loving, trusting relationship between the treaty partners, when you get to the Assyrian treaties, there is no historical prologue, there are no benevolent acts of the great king that are enumerated first, and instead you have the imposition of raw power on the vassal. The vassal is to do all these things, or else you have that double list of curses that he's to be plagued with if he doesn't. So the lack of a prologue is not only a difference in literary form, but it also sets a very different spirit in connection with the relationship between the treaty partners. So the quality of relationship established between the suzerain and his vassal is quite different. We need to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and look at some more of this. Yeah.
I'd like to just take a note from the library.